Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bog. Sorry we weren't live last week. I had my Winter Nights celebration with my clan. So we got together. We had a wonderful Winter Nights celebration. We had a camp out. It got freezing cold, way colder than we expected. So a bunch of us had to abandon tent and end up in my SUV where we huddled in like sardines and turned on the heater so we wouldn't freeze to death. And except for my one kinsman, he slept by the fire all night in his one of the big mummy sleeping bags. So that was a lot of fun. But we had a lot of fun. We did a lot of good eating. We did a lot of good stuff. And we had a very nice and special bloat. Everybody got together. So that was my Winter Nights thing. So that's why we weren't live on Saturday, unfortunately. But to make up for it, like always, we're going to do a double banger this week. And to start out this week, we have a really cool episode for everybody. But before we get started, I want to give some plugs. Facebook.com/Iron Age Jodish. Guys, I'm telling you. Actually, speaking of Iron Age Jodish, earlier today I got a message from one of the friends of the Bog, and he got the service of the Iron Age Jodish, and he sent me a message to tell me that it was really incredible, that he really loved Neil John's entire chart that he drew up, and he was really, really blown away by Neil John's service over at the Iron Age Jodish. So make sure to go over to facebook.com/Iron Age Jodish, tell him Big Dave sent you, and get yourself some authentic Vedic astrology. Really, really cool stuff. And also, make sure to go check out our Patreon, guys. We are getting funded now. We are moving up in the world. We got all kinds of stuff going on. We have a lot of ambitions, and we have a big scope for the Bog here. So if you like what the Bog does, you want to support the Bog, you want to see the Bog grow, help us upgrade our equipment, get out, do some more stuff, then go over to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50, and you get all kinds of different things in there. I think the stickers and t-shirts and, you know, all kinds of other stuff, as well as the big sign up for the Patreon is you get access to our RSS feed, where you can get audio of every single one of our podcast episodes. I'm a little bit backed up. I got a bunch more I got to upload, but you get RSS feed for all of our audio stuff, so you can listen to at work, at the gym, in your car, you so on and so forth. So make sure you go over to patreon.com/thebog. And also, we got all kinds of cool merch stuff, man. Cool stuff. Over at shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. I always forget to put it up on the screen here, but it'll be in the description, so you can go over. Man, we got t-shirts, we got tank tops, we got artisan chef aprons, we got coffee mugs, we got stainless steel insulated bottles for when you're at the gym. We have bucket hats and caps and dresses and maternity shirts and anything you can imagine, book bags, anything you can imagine in the form of Bog merchandise. Make sure you go over and get yourself some sweet Bog merch for all the Bog lords. Rep the Bog when you're on the streets. So anyway, without further ado, we're going to get started here. This is going to be the start of a series called Monsters of Myth, where we're going to go through and we're going to bring up the monsters and creatures and entities that are in the myth, specifically of the Norse, but we can also get into some other cultures as well, some other Indo-European cultures. And we're going to bring them up. We're going to give you guys a rundown. It's going to go into all of the monsters of myth. I don't know how many episodes of this we're going to do, but we're going to get right into it. So without further ado, let's get started right away. Riding shotgun, we got Tristan, Wolfman, and Andre from Norway. So, Mr. Tristan, give us a start. Tell us about one of your monsters you got lined up for us.
Well, Dave, I'm going to start us off with talking about the Mermenil. And I'm going to start here by reading off from a passage from, I believe the book is called Folk Tales of the Northmen, but don't hold me to that one because I didn't write it down. It says, "The merman was called Mermenil. His form and appearance are nowhere described, the most remarkable attribute of this being was his gift of prophecy. It was believed that if a man should be so fortunate as to fish up a merman from the sea, he could compel him to foretell his destiny. The Mermenil could also live a while upon dry land, but it took no pleasure in that kind of life and pined for its home in the sea. The mermaid, Margeiger, is described as having the form of a woman to the belt, but that of a fish below. It was believed to presage good or evil to seafarers. For instance, if one had risen above the surface of the sea, when it again dived under, it foreboded evil. If it turned itself towards the ship, but if it turned itself away from the ship, it was a presage of good." And I have here a passage from the book Curious Myths of the Middle Ages. And I'll read it from here that says, in the saga of Hálf and his knights is an account of a merman who was caught and kept a little while on land. He sang the following entreaty to be taken back to his native element. Cold water to the eyes, flesh raw to the teeth, a shroud to the dead. Flit me back to the sea, henceforward never men and ships sailing, draw me to dry land from the depth of the sea. In the Speculum Regal, an Icelandic work of the 12th century, is the following description of a mermaid. A monster is seen also near Greenland, which people call the Margaigir. This creature appears like a woman as far down as her waist, with breast and bosom like a woman, long hands and soft hair, the neck and head in all respects like those of a human being. The hands seem to people to be long, and the fingers not to be parted, but united by a web like that of a feet of water birds. From the waist downwards, this monster resembles a fish, with scales, tails, and fins. This prodigy is believed to show itself especially before heavy storms. The habit of this creature is to dive frequently and rise again to the surface with fishes in its hands. When sailors see it playing with the fish or throwing them towards the ship, they fear that they are doomed to lose several of the crew. But when it casts the fish or, turning from the vessel, flings them away from her, then the sailors take it as a good omen that they will not suffer loss in the impending storm. This monster has a very horrible face with broad brow and piercing eyes, a wide mouth and double chin. The Landnámabók, or Icelandic Domesday Book, speaks of a marmenil, or merman, having been caught off the island of Grimsey, and the annals of the same country relate the appearance of these beings off the coast in 1305 and in 1329.
Wow, that's incredible. So these are literally mermaids.
Yeah, basically the same mermaids you would think of from, you know, like the Disney story almost, except they just seem to be rather ugly.
Yeah.
And way more sinister. God.
Yeah, and way more sinister.
So, speaking of mermaids, I just want to mention this real quick. Did you guys see that? Do you remember that it was like on Discovery Channel, like a mockumentary thing?
Yes. About mermaids? Yeah,
yes. That was actually a really good program.
That fooled a bunch of my friends into thinking it was real. Like, my friends all gathered around it, like, dude, mermaids are real. And I'm like, guys, this is like fiction. No, dude, really, it's documentary. It's like, oh, jeez.
Which is exactly what happened in Iceland in 1300. Some dude was like, no, guys, seriously, I saw it. And they were like, no, fuck you.
Well, I'll tell you, speaking of that, the reason I brought that up is I literally just had an argument with a friend of mine. He was trying to convince me the mermaids were real, and he's still using the evidence put forth in that mockumentary. He's like pissed that they're hiding the truth about mermaids. I'm like, God, you gotta chill. Like, this is not
like
this
like
not
Alex
real.
Jones, but with the mermaids.
Yeah, he's pissed about it. Yeah. So,
well, don't tell him that apparently the evidence comes from the Landnámabók.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to tell him anything else to fuel his mermaid spiel. We're not fueling that anymore. But I'm going to ask this because I'm going to ask this about every monster we bring up. Tristan, what are the chances that this mermaid creature is real or could have been real at some point?
Well, you know, I tend to take the perspective that if my own specific ancestors believed that they saw this, they recorded it in their tales, and that it was well known amongst the sailors, I believe that it exists.
So, but to what capacity? Is this a supernatural creature? Is this?
Oh, I think it definitely has to be some sort of supernatural creature of some kind. I mean, it's associated as being half man and half fish almost, with the ability to foretell your own prophecy and your future.
So, this is, you know, obviously, I mean, I would be absolutely beyond shocked if it turned out that there were mermaids at some point or some sort of,
Perhaps they're servants of Aesir and Ran, or perhaps even of Njord.
That's possible as well.
Well, the Greeks, you know, in their traditions, I believe the hippocampus, if I'm not mistaken,
was a water horse. But you're thinking of the siren, which is very close.
No. I was going to say that in addition to that, there's like the Nereids and like other like oceanic, almost like fae creatures in a way.
I'm going to be talking about the Knocker and the Nick a little while later, so hold off on
okay.
that.
All right, I'll save that then.
Yeah. Speaking of Mr. Wolfman, I know you have some monsters lined up. This is kind of your alley here, so tell us about the first monster you got lined up.
Well, as an absolute shocker to everyone, I'm sure, I'm going to talk about wargs. probably one of the more famous ones, and I would say misconstrued. Like recently, Tristan and I ran afoul of some people with very interesting takes on wargs. But to start, I would say a lot of people are probably familiar with them as they're represented in like Tolkien's works or fantasy literature and whatnot, where they're just depicted as like large evil wolves, you know, usually of some kind of like demonic intelligence. And I believe in the Fellowship of the Ring, when Tolkien first introduced them and they attacked the Fellowship outside of Moria, when the next morning their corpses are all gone, because the implication is that that wargs specifically are like evil spirits or like wights that possess the bodies of wolves, which is why they're like intelligent and can like make treaties with orcs and stuff like that. But Tolkien, you know, being the Teutonic scholar that he was, despite his Catholicism, he took his concept of warg from, you know, the warg of our, you know, folk tales and mythologies and whatnot. And a warg is essentially just that. It's a, the word itself comes from the Old Norse, you know, vargr, which means a strangler, a robber, outlaw, you know, wolf. They're all basically titles for someone that's a bad customer, someone who has, you know, malevolent intent. So Fenrir is probably the most notorious example of a warg. You know, Rodsvitnir is one of his titles, which means famous wolf. And a note on that is that some scholars, like Rudolf Simek, who is an Austrian philologist and religious studies scholar, he has suggested that Skoll and Fenrir are actually the same entity and that it's just a different title. I'm going to go ahead and disagree with that on the basis that in the Völuspá poem, they are specifically described as being Fenrir's brood, i.e. his children. So I think we can kind of handedly throw that out, even though I respect that this guy is like a, you know, doctored professor and all that. I just don't think it's true. But moving on from there, Fenris, you know, we know his story from the fact that he's as a child of Loki, he's an agent of chaos. And so there is, and I've talked to Tristan about this before, there is, I would say, a decent case to say that you're sympathetic to Fenrir in the sense that, like, yeah, you were born to a kind of a bastard, so you kind of got the short end of the stick, but this is your fate. Unfortunately, that's just how it is. But then, you know, there's people like the Rokatru people and the Thursatru people who outright worship or honor Fenrir, and I feel like they've missed the entire point of that story.
Yeah.
And straight up dabbling in evil. And, you know, kind of like we covered on the Wolf Cult episode, I take personal offense to this because it's kind of like they're inverting an Odinic creed or theology and turning it on its head to corrupt it and make it malevolent. And I really don't like that.
And I just quickly wanted to mention that there are groups out there that are like Thursatru and like what Mr. Ian mentioned. Like there were members of the Rune Guild, I'm sure people are familiar with that term, that wanted to summon Fenrir. Like they're like they had specific rituals that they thought they were going to summon the Great Wolf.
Absolutely cringe. And the thing too that I kind of made the point like this, right? And this is where I say the real blasphemy and kind of heresy for me comes in that when I read over this material, because I was actually doing research on, you know, the Yarnvidr, the Ironwood, because I was trying to find more information on the denizens there, because in the literature it's described as being, you know, that easterly kind of spooky forest where the troll wives and the giantesses bear children in the form of wolves, and, you know, it's very grim and ominous sounding, and I wanted more information on it, so I was looking into it. And really, aside from the scant mentions where it's more or less listed as the domain of Fenrir and his children, it's really just a bunch of left-hand path occultists that are speculating on this kind of stuff. But I digress. The problem I have with them is that they conflate the wolf totemism of like Loki with that of Odin. And so an important thing to mention is that Loki's connected with wolves and that his child Fenrir is a wolf, and a lot of the Jotun are in the form of wolves. Skjold and Hati are like his grandchildren. They're also wargs that chase the sun and the moon respectively through the sky. But then there's Geri and Freki. And something I also really don't like is when people postulate that Geri and Freki are just different names for Fenrir, or they're different names for Skoll and Hati. These are very specifically Odin's companions. They're not Loki's children. Hmm. And the distinction there, and people will say, you know, oh, well, the difference is, you know, the other ones are wargs, they're evil wolves, and Gary and Freki are just regular wolves, like as if they were like the ones you'd see at the zoo. I think that this is wrong because in a lot of ways, if you look at Gary and Freki's names, they mean, you know, roughly translated, they mean like greedy, ravenous. And there's kennings for like decaying flesh, or carrion is Gary's morsel, Freki's, you know, Freki's morsel. Or they call blood, you know, Freki's wine. You know, basically to instill the idea that these two great wolves, these two wargs, are devourers of the slain, the dead. Like Odin is the god of the slain. They're his companions in the way that the Indo-Europeans have always connected canids to their death gods and rituals and whatnot. So conflating these two, what I consider kind of like sacred wargs, with like the ones that are outright evil and enemies of the gods, I think is blasphemous. And I think it really perverts the nature of kind of the Odinic wolf cult, the wolf warband, the Ulfhéðnir. I think that these Thursatru people are basically preaching what is, you know, carnage and Satanism, but calling it, you know, the wolf cult. And that really sits wrong with me. It fires me up. And the one last thing I wanted to mention about wargs is that Narfi, another connection, Narfi is Loki's son. And when Loki is punished at the end of Loksena, you know, after he's insulted all the gods and is going to get his just desserts, one of his sons is turned into a warg who then devours his brother, and then the entrails from his remains are used to bind Loki to the three stones. It's kind of interesting that I've postured before that I think wolves are very morally gray in Teutonic mythology. They're either associated with the gods in a positive way, or they're straight up enemies of the gods. It seems like in a lot of cases of Jotun, they can kind of determine what side they want to go with, like Mimir did, kind of. But in this case, we see them working with Jotun and being Jotun, but also punishing them, you know, being their sentence, their doom. And I think that's really interesting in the sense that, you know, much like men, wolves and wargs can kind of go either way. They have agency. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I've always kind of, when it came to wolves, period, I might have mentioned this in on our Wolf Called episode, but I very much view wolves as not so much aligned with good or evil, but as part of you know, wild nature. They are part of just primordial nature. So, you know, to me, when with Odin's wolves, he is essentially going with nature, because Odin is, you know, kind of a wild
guy. Exactly. You know, and I mean, see, that's the problem with these Lokians, is that they are essentially perverting the natural order, because they associate anything that is savage or dangerous with evil, with desolation, with, you know, the chaotic forces of the Jotun. When, you know, I love Jack London as an author, I call it the law of fang and claw. You know, nature, if you ever watch Discovery Channel after 9 p.m., it can be very violent. It can be very savage.
Well, it's the still perennial truth of good is not nice.
Exactly. Exactly. Good does not mean nice. And that's a modern trait that we kind of got to knock out of our heads. I think a lot of us retain a degree of that in some context or another. And to kind of get to your question before you ask it, Dave, I think, and Andre is actually the one that posed this theory to me, the idea that the difference between the warg and the wolf in our ancestors' mythologies could in some way be derived from the differences between the ancestral memory of a dire wolf versus the, you know, Canis lupus familiaris that would eventually be domesticated into the dog.
Fascinating. Yeah, yeah, that's a really good take. And we already covered, I don't want to go too far into wolves, because we did do a episode about wolves and stuff like that. But that's absolutely a really fascinating take. And also, it is really important to point out that when we talk about goodness, and we talk about, you know, these creatures, and we talk about the monsters of myth, not all of them are necessarily evil. You know, the way that we understand good in modernity is that good is kindness. I just wrote a thing about ripping up this kind of final amalgamation of New Ageism, which they call omnism. And that's just completely centered around the idea that everything, that all religions have pieces that are right, and the pieces that are right that should be taken out are the pieces that are nice, the pieces that are humanist. And this is obviously just like the biggest abomination I've ever seen in my entire life. But when we look at these creatures and these entities of myth, we have to look at them with the true lens of what good means. And that means fulfilling their purpose and becoming what they are and being what they are. That is what is good in far as like a teleological kind of way. But I don't want to get too far into all that stuff. So I'm gonna read a couple things and we're gonna pass it off to Andre here. So we have our boy Mr. Bartleby just resubbed for another month. He's on a 2-month streak. Hail to Bartleby, one of the best mods I ever had. Hail to Hearth and Helm. Everybody should tune in and sub to Hearth and Helm. Excellent, excellent podcast with very, very smart ladies. I really, really enjoy them. We interviewed them, I guess, like a month or two back. Really, really smart ladies. I love them. And this week they're going to have Miss Motherhen, our good friend Motherhen, over there on Hearth and Helm. So everybody make sure you sub over there and check them out. And then our boy, Letty Decay, with a ninja gini. He dropping a gini on us. He says, "Are you hiding, Mr. Big Dave?" "Don't. You can't." All right, that's... I'm not. I guess that's a little. I don't even know what to say to that. Like, I don't know.
It sounds a little threatening, yeah, doesn't it?
Yeah. Light of Decay.
What's Light of Decay got cooked up? He's going to be putting some bad images at our next work, isn't he?
Yeah. Light of Decay is a good friend of the show, good friend of mine. He does all of our graphics, so everything that you see Bog related comes from the masterful work of Mr. Light of Decay, one of the best graphic artists out there today. So before we suck up too much time, let's go right over to Andre. Andre, what do you have in the books for us?
I guess it should also come as no surprise to anybody who knows me, but I also chose this because this is like the quintessential Scandinavian folk creature from folklore that most people are familiar with. It's the Kraken.
Very cool.
As we say, Kraken. It's like a bit of a different pronunciation. And I wanted to get into the etymology of the name, actually, somewhat in the beginning, because that's kind of interesting. Where the name comes from, as it comes from the original name comes from Old Norse, Kraki, which is a word that was used to describe something that was ill or sickly, usually describing an animal, like a sickly animal, you would call it Kraki. It's similar to how I suppose the Germans used the term Kranken to refer to someone who's sick. It's the same origins of the words. And the Kraken, I'm just going to say that for ease of access, is usually depicted as a giant squid, as a 10-armed octopus, basically. It was also used as a name, slang term mostly, in some places of Norway, using kraken or krake as a word for an octopus or a squid, usually. It also bears other names, usually something along the lines of anchor troll, the kraxen, the crawler, krabben, or hurven. And so this has several names in Scandinavia. It's usually only referred to as the kraken in the Anglosphere, however. Another interesting thing about the name that I ended up digging up, actually, was that the word kraken was also used as a slang term, as a kind of a too taboo word, for referring to a whale, because the original depiction that was mentioned in the 1200s and 1250 about in the Edda, they talk about two specific sea monsters, one called Lyngbakr and the other one Hafguta. One of them being a giant crab-like creature, more crab-like or somewhat whale-like, that had an island on its back, and the older one was just described as a generalized sea monster that caused the sea to rise and steam and cook, basically. Allegedly something along the lines of creating a whirlpool, which they later attested this to the Kraken as being its favorite method of hunting. It usually was so large that if you ever saw it move, it would create ripples and waves, like huge waves and ripples. And if it hunted, it usually would lie down on the seafloor and open its mouth to spew out sewage frankly unpleasant image to attract a bunch of fish. And then it would create a whirlpool and pull everything into its mouth. This was its favorite method of hunting, and this is also kind of where this idea of it eating both fish, whales, and ships who happened to be on top of it. What? Okay, never mind. I thought I heard something. The idea of Kraken being more of a squid creature. It came about in the 1500s or the 1700s, about that's when the first time it was written specifically to be squid-like. And it kind of stuck from there, it seems, but the origins of it being a giant squid seems to be far, far older than that. It's what's generally just seen as a sea monster, but a sea monster could mean a lot of different things, especially to sailors. Especially also since sailors are not always known to tell the truth, or at least embellish it somewhat.
So, but let me ask you. I mean, we went over, and I forgot to ask Ian, and we're going to go back to him after this. But so we kind of covered this as far as the giant squid in the Mysteries of the Endless Ocean episode. What chances are there, like these krakens that you're talking about specifically within the folklore, not just the giant squid, but like these giant bizarre whale creatures and stuff like that that these sailors saw or these our ancestors saw? What are the chances that these creatures were real?
Well, that was something I've actually looked quite a bit into, and I also cover this when I have talked about it all the times as well. Is that it's said the Kraken dwells around the coast of Norway. It also swims around the coast of Iceland, Greenland, to the Outer Hebrides of the British Isles, and between the Straits of Sweden and Denmark. And this is firmly within the North Sea continental shelf. And we know that's a hot spot for the giant squid. Specifically.
Wow.
And I'm not talking about the giant squid as like, oh yeah, surely this is the giant squid, but the giant squid and the colossal squid are two species of basically the same family tree. And what's somewhat interesting to note about cephalopods, because cephalopods are freaks of nature. They are strange, strange creatures that act really weirdly. One of my main points of evidence here is that the Kraken, for instance, being aggressive, attacking ships and so forth, we know that happens. The Humboldt squid is a good example of an aggressive squid. This is a squid that's about 1 to 2 meters long, and it attacks people. We also know that the giant squid has been known to get into somewhat of a scuffle with sperm whales. We have spotted sperm whales and old whalers' tales tell of sperm whales that have wounds on their bodies and marks of barbed suction cups on their bodies far larger than they should be. You also have concept, this is a real scientific concept, that they have a trouble explaining. The further down into the sea you go, the smaller the creatures become, until you reach a certain point past the twilight zone where no light actually reaches, the animals get significantly bigger. This is called deep sea gigantism. We don't know how this happens. We don't know why it happens, but creatures far down into the sea can grow to tremendous sizes.
Like how big? And give us some examples of like, because this is really curious to me. This is my first time hearing this. Like what are some examples, some freakishly large things that end up with at the bottom of the sea?
Well, not necessarily like super freakishly large, but you have viper fish, for instance. If you're familiar with a viper fish, it's a long, elongated, eel-like creature and with a horrific mouth, but they can grow easily 3, 4, 5 meters long. That's quite much larger than they should be able to get down there, specifically when you're dealing with the deep sea, which has a lack of food.
And 5 meters would be like 15 feet, right?
Yeah, about 15 feet, yeah. And then you have the sleeper sharks, they can grow to the size of a great white shark. They're just as big.
Wow.
Slightly smaller, but some of them are far larger. They can also usually live to about 400 or 500 years, as far as we know.
Wow.
And this is really strange.
What about the gulper eels are pretty big too, aren't they? I don't know the dimensions. But.
The gulper eels would be around the same feet as, like, the same amount of feet as a viperfish would be. But the giant squid is a perfect example of how large things can get, because they can easily reach like 11, 12 meters.
Well, I just want to comment that you said that the deep sea is a place where there's gigantism abounding and we don't really know why. There's that theme in mythology and stuff that, like, these dark hidden places, be it the Ironwood or the Abyss, these places that are hidden away from the sight of gods and men, in a way, they're kind of like where evil, and, or, well, not evil necessarily, but where fell things, be they evil or just really big and scary, can kind of grow unblemished. You know what I mean?
Well, that's what I meant, though, with the deep sea, is that things are really strange the further down you go. One of my final points I want to make regarding cephalopod biology, be that octopuses or squids, is that some species don't actually have a limitation to how big they can grow. Some of them stop growing once they reach maturity and breed. They stop growing at that point. However, if they don't breed, they keep growing because they don't have an internal body structure or a body plan that stops them. They don't have a skeleton. So they can just keep growing, theoretically, infinitely.
Wow.
So what you're telling us is that the Kraken is really just a giant virgin.
That's actually said in the text as well, because they're said to be two of them and they don't breed because the numbers don't seem to increase. So you have two virgin Krakens that just sit there and just scowl at each other.
That's why they're so mean to boats.
Yeah, exactly.
They're all backed up.
Wait, what's a Kraken version of blue balls? Like ink? I don't know.
Blue tentacle.
So I actually wanted to pass back.
We'll call it Black Sack.
Yeah. I wanted to pass it back over to Ian real quick and ask you. We mentioned about wolves and stuff like that, and actually, believe it or not, I was watching. I've been on like a kind of a cryptid kick lately, just like looking into some stuff because we had this episode coming up. So I wanted to just kind of like, you know, go see what's going on with cryptids and get into the mind of it. And I saw quite a few videos. One of the most common cryptids that people see are like giant wolves. They see these giant wolves. They see wolf men. They see, you know, demonic wolves, as they would describe them, supernatural wolves. Sometimes, I believe there was one here in Pennsylvania that they just call the Black Wolf, and yep. he hangs out in areas that are abandoned coal camps and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And he's absolutely gigantic. You know, people run into him, they see him, he's ferocious. You know, he eats other people's pets, he rips up bears, like all kinds of like really bizarre stuff. They run into him, they see him, they try to track him, he's gone. You know what I mean? So it's like, yeah. What are the chances that these wargs are real and these cryptids that people are calling like the Black Wolf are actually real life wargs?
God, I could literally go for hours on that because you're getting in like black dogs and whatnot, which is probably my favorite topic aside from this sort of thing. But I'm going to go ahead and say there's no chance because they're absolutely real. Prior to, you know, joining this merry band of adventurers, my primary interest and focus was like skinwalkers, you know, kind of Native American animal, like half man, half beast kind of folklore cryptids, especially black dogs and like weird, like hellhound kind of things. I have documented evidence that shows that hybrids in the wild, like peoples that their wolf dog, like German Shepherd wolf crossover that mates with a wolf in Wyoming, that offspring will be bigger because for whatever reason, as they successively mate and have increasing generations, they don't seem to have a size limitation. Like, wolf dogs, for example, and I know from experience, they actually tend to be a bit bigger than actual wolves because there's no limitation on size based on, you know, two timber wolves breeding together, having that limitation.
Hybrid vigor.
Exactly. So there's that, and I've seen documented pictures. I've seen a coyote wolf hybrid in Wyoming, and that thing was absolutely massive. Like, it's the size of almost like a small pony. Now, the dire wolves were absolutely a thing. We have fossil record to establish that they exist. There is a chance that some of these sightings could be, like, not dire wolves necessarily, but, you know, dire wolves were really common in North America, and a lot of these sightings are in North America. I don't think it's impossible to say that maybe some, like, dire wolf genetic or trait slipped into the timber wolf genome and just kind of stuck around. Like, not saying that these are actual dire wolves, but just maybe that they have some of that essence in them.
But what do you think about the possibility that these creatures are some sort of spiritual being, like a ghost or something, like a memory of ancient undead wolves? Okay. What do you think about it?
I've podcasted about that before for hours, so I don't want to go too heavy on it, but we can always revisit it. But I will say, the black dog ghost spirit thing, it is absolutely real. I've had encounters with them my entire life, going back to childhood. That's part of the reason why I'm so hard on the Gary and Frecky totemism. My girlfriend has legitimately had paranormal experiences where she thinks she sees them walking around our house, and she does a double take, realizing that it's not actually our dog. But so, in addition to, you know, personal anecdote and, you know, the investigations I've done into people that claim to have seen them and stuff, I've noticed really that the black dog, you know, spirit phenomenon is incredibly linked to the Teutonic people. And what I mean by this is, a lot of people say it's a Celtic thing because you have the Welsh Gwyllgi and all that sort of thing. And I do think the Celts definitely have a tradition of it that's very similar. However, if we look at the black dog stories, and I've actually got a wonderful book that's out of print by an old English couple, but it basically is a list of all the different sightings and legends about these things going back to the Middle Ages. And what we find is that they're really common in continental Germany. They're really common in the Low Countries, where among Dutch speakers, you know, Flanders and Belgium and what is now the Netherlands. Alsace and, you know, Lorraine, like very eastern France, where it starts to bleed into Germany. And then England. But specifically the parts of Britain where they're really common are places that were heavy, heavy settled by Scandinavians and Anglo-Saxons, like the former Danelaw, the former Anglia, Lincolnshire, East Anglia, Cumbria, Yorkshire. These are all hotspots for this kind of thing. I think they're absolutely real, and kind of agreeing with Tolkien in a way, I think that there's an aspect of them that's not biological at all. I think they're very much an eldritch entity. And they can, like I was saying earlier, they can be good or bad. I think a spectral canid can be, you know, kind of a protector and a guide, or it can be a malicious hellhound out to get you. I 100% believe they're real.
Well, certainly, right. I think a wolf spirit could actually be one of the Landvader.
I will do.
Or a Filgia.
What do you mean?
Or a Filgia, that would also be
Tristan.
Well, you know, the Landvader are nature spirits that protect plots of land. It could range from like a specific corner of the field up to like an entire section of a country, depending on how powerful they are. But they're beings that, you know, they're basically minor Alfar that our ancestors propitiated with sacrifice. And they take all kinds of different forms, ranging from giants, men, women, different types of animals, dragons, mythological creatures. Yeah. So, I mean, it's definitely within the realm of possibility that one could take the form of a great big wolf.
Personally, I agree with you wholeheartedly. I just I don't take this as any kind of factoid. This is my personal belief. I kind of consider Gary and Frecky almost to be like the alphas of that sort of thing. And like, they are specifically Odin's like intrusion of order and Asa hierarchy onto that sort of system, if that makes sense.
Sure.
I've always had the perspective that they should realistically be connected to the soul structure in some way, but I've never been able to find a way to solidly link that in the same way that you could link Hunan and Munin.
Yeah.
I want to interject with at least one other aspect. I'm not necessarily talking away from the spiritual aspect of this, but I want people to keep in mind that the direwolf, when we're talking about the species of direwolf, existed like heavily in Germany, and the latest fossil discovery that we made of that went extinct 9,500 years ago.
That's recent.
Very recent.
Very recent, yeah. Oh, same thing with like the Aurochs and stuff like that. I mean, people think those are long gone, and they've only been gone for a few centuries.
Yeah, exactly. And for folks that are maybe not familiar with some of the language and terminology that we're using, Tristan mentioned Landvater, which means land father. It's like a land spirit, Landvater. So let's keep the train going, Mr. Tristan. What else did you have on the list? I know you had another creature lined up.
Right, I wanted to talk about the Nick, which is what I'm going to be mostly using to describe the thing, but it's also referred to by a whole bunch of different names across the Germanic world, variations of the same title, such as the Nox, the Nixie, the Nicker, the Knocker. But anyway, I will be referring to it as the Nick, because that's the terminology that most of my sources use here. And it says here, the Nick is described as a horse of a dapple gray color, whose place of resort was in freshwater streams, where it sometimes made its appearance on the banks. It appears to have been exceedingly strong, and it sometimes allowed itself to be taken by men and set to work during the day. But when the sun went down, it tore itself out of the harness and ran off into the water again. Thus it is related of a certain Offenvalisen, a settler of Iceland, that during harvest time he saw a dapple gray stallion run out from Hjatharbotn to one of his horses. Often caught the gray horse, harnessed it to a sled, which was usually drawn by two oxen, and hauled all his hay together with it. The horse was very easily managed in the middle of the day, but as evening came on it, it became restive and stamped in the ground up to its fetlocks. And after sunset, it broke out of the harness, ran to the water, and was never seen again. It appears, however, that the Nick, especially in the Christian Middle Ages, was regarded as a being that could assume various forms. In Norway and Iceland, the people still believe in the existence of this being, and they usually describe it just as it is described by the ancients. In Iceland at the present day, it is called Nikkr and also Vatnhest, or Nenir. Another belief was that if a person brought the Nock a treat of three drops of blood, a black animal, some brandvin, which is a type of Scandinavian vodka, or snus, which is a wet snuff, dropped into the water, he would teach his enchanting form of music. The Nock was also an omen for drowning accidents. He would scream at a particular spot in a lake or river, and on that spot, a fatality would later take place. He was also said to cause drownings, but swimmers could protect themselves against such a fate by throwing a bit of steel in the water. In Scandinavia, water lilies are called Nix roses. A tale from the forest of Tveden relates that a father promised his daughter to a Nokken who offered him great hauls of fish in a time of need. She refused and stabbed herself to death, staining the water lilies red from that time on. And thus it is related. At the lake of Fagertarn, where there was once a poor fisherman who had a beautiful daughter, the small lake gave little fish, and the fisherman had difficulties providing for his little family. One day, as the fisherman was fishing in his little dugout of oak, he met the Nokken, who offered him great catches of fish on the condition that the fisherman gave him his beautiful daughter the day she was 18 years old. The desperate fisherman agreed and promised the Nokken his daughter. The day the girl was 18, she went down to the shore to meet the Nokken, and the Nokken gladly asked her to walk down to his watery abode, where the girl took forth a knife and said that he would never have her alive, then stuck the knife into her heart and fell down into the lake dead. Then her blood colored the water lilies red, and that from that day on, the water lilies of some of the lake's forests are red.
Wow. Creepy.
Yeah, very creepy, isn't it?
So it starts out as just like a magic river horse, and then turns into like this diabolical creature.
Well, I want to say one thing, because I might think it might be interesting. I was literally warned about this creature when I was a kid. This is a story that was told to kids in Norway and as recently as my generation.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, the quote I was pulling from is actually from the beginning of last century, so it's a bit out of date when it says that Scandinavians still believe in it, but it was definitely true at the time.
There was a few disparities, though, because we usually say that it can take the form of a beautiful grayish-white horse, usually a white horse. It can also take the form of a beautiful woman or a very handsome man, depending on the gender of who is going nearby the ponds, usually where it dwells.
Yeah,
or it can take.
Especially in Scandinavia, during the later Middle Ages, the tradition of the Knocker changed into take the form of a man who would play a violin in a stream or something of that sort.
Oh yeah, that's also something. If you heard violin music in the forest, you were just supposed to get out. That was not good news. It could also take the form of a raft, and if you went on the raft or sat on the horse or followed the beautiful man or handsome man, you would drown. It would literally hunt you to try and drown you and try and trick you, but you had to go willingly.
Well, it's like the common theme with like the Celtic Fae, right? These are more or less quasi-elemental beings, especially associated with the water or with like the underground, and their primary goal seems to be to take human mates or brides or whatever and to drag them down into their watery abodes and whatnot. And this is kind of interesting because you said that the belief in these creatures is as recent as your generation. I would say that we still believe in them here, albeit in different terms. For example, the missing 411 is a common cryptozoology lightning rod. And when I first heard about that theory, I thought, oh, it's woods hobos, black bears, and maybe some Sasquatch. But after hearing a friend present the idea that it was like fey creatures that resided in boulder fields and dry creek beds and in bodies of water, and, comparatively looking at stories like of the knockers and the like what Tristan was just quoting and Celtic sources as well, it's funny, the idea of a fairy is like Tinkerbell or something like that. But in reality, these things are absolutely creepy. And the fact that they use, I don't know if seduction is the right word, but they use pleasing forms and pleasant music.
I would call it more like deception or mystery.
Yeah, no, it is deception. But it's deception that is specifically not scary. It's not creepy. It's just like, oh, everything's nice. Come on and lay down. It's very Slaneshy. I don't like it.
Playing violin music in the middle of a forest is the... It's creepy. It's really creepy.
I'll tell it at a future future date, but a few friends of mine and I, we were hiking in the woods one time at like 1 a.m, and we heard some really strange eldritch music. And I mean, we actually ran down the mountain and got out of there. I'll tell the story at a future date, but it was very much kind of in this vein of encounter or story.
When I was a kid, the property that I grew up on, in the field behind our house, we always equated it to because there was like a long time ago, there was another property there and there was a young lady that got murdered in those woods. And we always equated it to that it was the ghost of this woman that got murdered there. But there was some sort of spirit in these woods. Like everybody, like every single one of my friends that I grew up with saw her. All of these things. But like at night, people would like look out and they would see this like white figure walking around in the field and in the woods. And all of my neighbors saw her. Like everybody in the area knew that she was there. One of the telltale things that she was like in the area was one of two things. Sometimes she would let out this like crazy scream and you would hear like running and going through the woods. And then another time you would hear like singing, like you would hear like this weird, I guess, like, I don't know what even the word for it. Cause it's not like it's like you hear somebody actually playing music. It's like this haunting psychic kind of melody.
Dude.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Does that make sense?
No, I know exactly what you mean. The thing I was talking about, that's exactly what we heard. And when I first heard it, I thought it was some kind of, because this was like 2011 when like trance music was really popular. And I thought it was some weird people in the forest that were like listening to a boombox with like their weirdo trance music, like doing drugs or something. But the more I listened to it, it didn't sound like music as we know it. It was just kind of like... It wasn't nature sounds. It wasn't music. It was like that ethereal, psychic, weird. I don't even know what to call it, but you're exactly right describing it.
Yeah, it's really. I never stuck around to see. Every time I heard that or something, even when I was a little kid, because my neighbor was he had a lot of stories. He used to tell me stories about gnomes and goblins and like all kinds of stuff that lived in the woods, and so I was like naturally really freaked out. So every time I would hear anything even close to this, I would run, and it's not like I heard it all the time. It was like maybe a few times. But anyway, it was like the concept of music or singing or a melody or something is very commonly associated with these fae and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, since it's relevant, would you want me to tell that story now or do you want me to save it for a future date?
Let's, we're coming up on, we got 10 minutes left, so let's save that one for a future day. Let's move over to, Mr. Wolfman. What was your second guy?
Well, I was actually going to broach the topic of dragons, but I don't know if 10 minutes is enough to do that justice. So I mean, what I was thinking was kind of almost not in an argumentative way, but I kind of consider dragons to be almost a form of Jotun, and I was wondering what you guys think about that.
Well, I mean, I think in the lore itself, some of the dragons seem to be very well associated with the forces of chaos or the Jotnar, but also we see them related in the, such as one of the Duergar or the dwarves turns into a dragon, the dragon Fafnir.
Fafnir, yeah.
Due to his own greed. So it seems like they have a sort of connection with that sort of area, like with Niflheim itself, but also with the mortal realm. And it's perhaps the case that there are multiple types of dragons in the Norse myth, and we just don't really know enough to differentiate about them.
Yeah, a distinct thing I see, because as you know, I mentioned to you before, some people are of the opinion that dragons are not all that common in Teutonic mythology and folklore, and that just strikes me as absurd, because you know, we have, you know, Nidhogg, who's at the base of the Yggdrasil, devouring the corpses of the sinful. You have Jormungand, who's, I mean, oh, you could say it's a sea serpent, but, I mean, what is a dragon? And then there's different kinds. You know, there's the terrestrial kind, the mountainous kind, the oceanic kind, in my opinion.
You have the worms in Niflhel?
Right, exactly. You have lindworms, wyverns, like all these sorts of serpentine draconids, let's just say. But also, you know, yeah, they're associated with chaos and, you know, destruction and the elements in a lot of ways. Like in Europe, they're typically associated with more like the earth and fire, and in Asia, more wind and water. But they're also fonts of wisdom in a lot of cases. Like, I mean, when Sigurd roasts Fafnir's heart and then, you know, burns his finger on it and then licks his finger, he can understand the language of birds. So there's this kind of weird, kind of like, you know, the how the Jotun are associated with chaos and danger, but also knowledge. I think the dragons kind of fulfill that archetype in a lot of ways, as well as kind of the guardian vibe, in that even if they're malevolent, they seem to often be placed in positions where they're supposed to guard something or keep something at bay. And furthermore, you know, to further attack the idea that dragons are not that popular or prevalent in Teutonic folklore, you know, the academic in me wants to remind everybody that most of what we know as, like, you know, Middle Ages, like Christian, like, you know, the knight slays the dragon, like St. George kind of thing. Most of that is just, you know, as an archetypical story, is ripped straight from Sigurd and Fafnir in many respects.
Yeah.
And beyond that, beyond Sigurd's story, I mean, there's a lot of those dragon facing the warrior champion stories. They come from the migration era, you know, the great period of the Volkswanderung, when the Teutonic people spread out across Europe and dominated the continent. And, you know, you have these early stories from when they were still very much pagan of, you know, great warriors, you know, killing the lindworm or the dragon that's in the mountain or something like that. And even the Christian sources, you know, the Arian, the early Gothic Arians, that was later declared a heresy, and in my opinion, not that I'm doing any defense of Christianity or anything, but I think the Arian heresy was more or less Christianity specifically tailored to suit the Goths, because the Goths were recorded as, you know, one of their primary gods being their war god, you know, Tyr, who they offered sacrifices of hanged men and stuff to. So it was really easy to take these warrior martial people, the Tervingi and Othringi and all that, and just say, yeah, you know, that god you already worship is this, so, you know, go kill dragons and stuff. So really, a lot of the Christian European Middle Ages dragon folklore is Teutonic folklore, just kind of copy-pasted in their own format.
Well, we also have to remember that one of the pinnacle prime conduits for the Indo-European myth in general is the myth of the thunder striker versus the serpent. And this shows up in pretty much every Indo-European culture in some form.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And I will say that the idea of the dragon, you know, we kind of, when we think of dragons today, we think of dragons very much in the very Tolkien or like Dungeons and Dragons kind of sense.
Right.
That, which aren't too far off from these, you know, other dragons. And you mentioned how they're associated with the Jotnar. And I want to bring that up because who are the Jotnar? Who are the Jotun? What is their, one of their driving forces? What is one of their driving elements of their being? That is like to be a devourer. They cannot stop eating. They cannot stop drinking. They cannot stop, you know, they are just impulsive, primordial, and it always ends up like destroying them or screwing them over or so on and so forth, that they can't stop their greed of whatever it be.
That's a good metaphor for today, definitely.
So when we look at dragons, how, like, all across the board, we look at these dragons, and I'm playing a game right now. I'm going back and I'm playing. It's called Dragon's Dogma. And in Dragon's Dogma, this dragon is very much just driven by destruction. He's born from some hellmouth and comes into the material world and just lays waste and is just driven by, like, destruction. So,
well,
when you look at the Tolkien dragon, more specifically in The Hobbit, you know, the desolation of Smaug and all that. Smaug. Yeah. What was Smaug all about? Smaug was about
treasure,
sleeping on that big pile of dwarven gold forever and ever because he loved it. So I don't think that your Jotun dragon correlation is that far off. I think it's pretty good.
You know, I've always liked the Shadowrun take on the matter, that when the world of magic and the world of modernity meet together, when the dragons come into our world, that they basically just fit themselves right in as bankers.
The whole lizard people things are, like, off on, like, left field, but I have postured to Andre before over the years. I just get the vibe. A lot of the things people dismiss handedly as fantastical are out of the question. It's like, if these things are known to be shapeshifters and have powers of illusion, what makes you think that they can't pass off as, like, you or I? You know?
And also, I'm a very firm believer of modern people have lost their connection to the supernatural, to the metaphysical.
Absolutely.
I think that people nowadays are so materialist. Even people that are even us here that are spiritual and religious, compared to our ancestors, we have parts of our brain that just aren't working. You know what I mean? We can't see and commune with these things anymore. Doesn't mean that they're not real. Doesn't mean that they don't have influence on today's society. They don't have influence on us, but that we just can't see them all the time.
Well, even in Icelandic sources of the sagas, it's very well noted that some people have the ability to see what they refer to as a second sight. That, like they can see the Alfar walking around and Fylgia following people, whereas other people couldn't.
Yeah, and I don't know if anybody here is familiar with Edgar Cayce, but Edgar Cayce was, we could do a whole show talking about him and guys like him, but Edgar Cayce was known as the Sleeping Prophet. He was he's the most prolific seer recorded in history. He had over, like, 15,000 readings. There's an entire library dedicated to researching his readings. Not one of his readings has ever been proven false, and they've all been either proven or not come to fruition yet. And one of the things, and I read, he's got a book called or no, he doesn't, but it's called The Edgar Cayce Companion, and or compendium or something like that. And in the book, it has parts of his journal from when he was a little kid. And he said, as a little kid, he would see elves and fairies and spirits dancing around in the woods. He would see them just all the time. Now, being he's from a Protestant Appalachia family, he described them as angels. He said, "I see these fairies and these sprites and spirits and stuff, but I believe," he actually says this, "I see them, but I believe that they are angels." So it's, I think that there's a lot of truth in that there are certain people that have this second.
Sounds like a lot of cope, Dave.
What?
It sounds like he's coping.
Right, that's what I meant.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's a joke. Okay. Yeah. It's like, wait, hold on now there, cowboy.
So.
No. I see a whole bunch of fairies and supernatural beings and everything, but they're just angels. Yeah, that works.
Yeah.
I see a bunch of fairies, but that was just when I was in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, right.
honestly, though, when it comes to, like, no matter where you are in the world, like, everybody's going to call it something different, but there seems to be a fundamental theme that most people, or if not all people, see something like a spiritual entity. Be they call them elves, dwarves, you call them alpha, you call them angels,
demons,
spirits, demons, whatever. Like, everybody sees them. Everybody has them.
I talked about it on the last Halloween episode. I actually saw one once for, like, 45 seconds. It was quite a long time.
Well, you guys, have you ever had the sleep paralysis hag kind of thing?
Yes.
I have that probably once every 2 weeks, and actually Andre's wife recommended that I start sleeping with a knife under my pillow, an iron knife, to keep it away. So I have a K-bar under my pillow, and I haven't had it since. I don't know if that's why or not.
I have a big problem with the night hag, and that's kind of probably be my one. We'll talk about that next episode, but we'll run out of time. Mr. Andre, what was your last monster you had?
The last monster I had was it ended up being a rabbit hole of generally a theme of sea serpents in lakes. I'm not just talking about the Loch Ness monster, we're also talking about the Scandinavian ones. There's several notable ones in Scandinavia, both in Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and Iceland.
Well, you know, if it sounds like that's going to be such a great topic, why don't we just save it for part two of Monster?
Yeah, I was thinking so, because it ended up being a very deep rabbit hole.
All right. All right, we'll close it out, and we'll save it for the next episode. I didn't think we were gonna go over this long, but it's all good. It's all good. All good stuff. And thank you to my co-hosts for hopping on and riding shotgun with me on the bog here. And thank you to everybody that has tuned in this evening, all of our generous donors, Light of Decay, Bartleby. Much love to everybody. Much love to Hearth and Helm, who's in the chat. Everybody should tune in and sub to those ladies over there. Everybody make sure to go over to facebook.com/IronAgeJodish and go check out some authentic Vedic astrology. I'm telling you, this guy is unbelievable. He's unbelievable. So if you go over there and you check him out and you decide to get on with some Vedic astrology, get your own chart and everything like that, make sure you tell him Big Dave sent you. Tell him Big Dave sent you. Go give him some love. And then also, if you like the bog, you support the bog, you want to see the bog grow and expand and get into more avenues and more stuff, make sure to go to patreon.com/thebog and go sign up. We have tiers going from $5 all the way up to $50, so you can get access to our RSS feed, so you can get audio of every single bog episode, so you can listen to it at work, at the gym, in your car, wherever, and all that good stuff. And also make sure you check out our we got some merch over at shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. I'll have it in the description over on YouTube, which you guys should go over and like, subscribe, share over there. Give us a hand. Guys, if you like the bog, you want to see us grow, go pick your favorite episode of the bog. Go over to the YouTube channel, grab the link, drop it into your Telegram, drop it into your Facebook group, drop it to wherever you are, your Discord, wherever you're hanging out, wherever you you do your social media stuff. Give it a drop. Make a post about it. Tell everybody why you like it, and give us some help growing. But at the end here, we're going to give a hail to our most exalted supporters. I'm going to raise the horn. I got the horn here. I don't have my light on or my camera on because it's ripping hot. And I don't want to see it. I don't want everybody seeing me sweating like a pig. But I have my horn in here in hand. And I'm going to raise a horn to our supporters, our exalted supporters, which is the Allens, House Allen, our very good friends, Chris and Katie. Much love. Many blessings to them. Hail to them and our boy, Mr. Corey, a good friend of the show. Many, many thanks to you guys, man. We couldn't do it without you guys. We couldn't do it without everybody tuning in. So much love, many blessings, and we'll see you guys next time on the bog. Hail!